Catching up with our great friend Dustin Dupirak from the Indianapolis Star, the beat writer for the Pacers. And, well, the NBA season is not over. It will start to be over tomorrow night as the NBA Finals begin in Boston, the Celtics and the Mavericks. And Pacer fans, we don't have to remind you what the Celtics and Pacers did in the Eastern Conference Finals, but we are here to relive, well, a fantastic playoff run, one that we haven't seen that deep in a decade, one that I don't think anybody 2 months ago would have said, oh, yeah, that's feasible. And we'll talk about how it wrapped up, what's next for the blue and the gold, free agency, restricted free agency, the draft, everything going on. And Dustin Dupirak is our great friend to join us this afternoon. Follow him at Dustin Dupirak on the X. And, of course, always support local journalism. Buy a subscription, IndyStar.com as well. Hey, buddy, thanks for joining us today. Happy June. And we know if it's June, that must mean the NBA Finals, as we mentioned, are around the corner. You got some extra work in the month of May covering the blue and the gold. And, well, I don't know when Benedict Mathurin went down in March that anybody would have circled that on their calendar. So this Pacer team punched above its weight. It gave Boston, I thought, everything it wanted and more in the Eastern Conference Finals. If you just fly over and see 4-0 sweep, you think, well, that's not surprising. But this team found some kind of identity late in the season and did so without Mathurin, and you can even make the argument really without Jairus Walker. The future is bright, but let's look at the past first, buddy. I thought they played great, and I'm a proponent of wins and losses. There is no column for tried really hard or was close in 3 or 4 games. I get it. It's the pros. You lose, you lose. But I thought there was nothing from those performances, besides game 2, and that's going to happen against a good team, where this franchise, you say, well, geez, there's no hope in this moving forward. This is just, they got lucky, they did this. I didn't read it that way. Now that you've had a week or 10 days to think about it, what is your recap from the Eastern Conference Finals?
Yeah, no, I mean, to your point, I mean, obviously they were able to be competitive in 3 of those 4 games. And so, you know, is that the closest you can be? No. I mean, there's certainly, you've certainly seen closer, basically, you know, conference final series. You certainly saw, obviously, Miami and Boston went to 7 last year, where Miami managed to eke it out as an 8 seed, you know, basically going up 3-0, losing it, and then coming back and taking it. But, you know, the Pacers belong on the floor with the Celtics, and I think you could make a case that at least by the end of the season, with what everybody had, they were the best, you know, basically team to face Boston in the East, considering just how hurt everybody else was. You know, obviously what the time lost, but for Joel Embiid when it came to Philadelphia, you know, the Bucks without Giannis at the end of the day, you know, this was the most competitive team that you could put up against the Celtics, because obviously they were able to score with them. They had the same amount of close to the same amount of offensive firepower, and that put them in every game. And obviously they have reason to kick themselves for the games they lost. Certainly game 1, you know, not calling timeout to advance the ball and end up turning the ball over in their own backcourt, and that leads to the Jaylen Brown tying 3-pointer and overtime and whatnot, everything that happened from there, and certainly a whole bunch of just dribbling off the foot and whatnot. They were very close to having a win in that game. So, I mean, in game 3 and game 4, they had, you know, possibilities, and they obviously just fell down the stretch, but you did not see a team that didn't belong on the court with the Boston Celtics. And so that tells you that they're pretty far along. I mean, I think I think Pascal Siakam did a good job of making the case and making sure that everybody, nobody thinks like this is where they start 2024-25, that basically you begin and then it's about taking next steps. And then, you know, like all you have to do is take a couple and all of a sudden you're in the NBA Finals. That's not exactly how it works. It's going to be harder for this team to get back next year, just to get back to where it was. But I do think it's established itself as a team that's a playoff team and that's competitive with the best team in the league. And, you know, belongs on the floor with them. And that's big strides, you know, from last year, from 2 years ago, you know, from 25 to 35 to being in the Eastern Conference Finals. That's tell you, you've gone a long way. And a lot of what you have, you have a really good foundation to go forward. There's steps they need to make, and there's deals they're going to have to make eventually, either this summer or later. But they have just come a long way in a couple of years. And again, I do think what the finals, Eastern Conference Finals, told you was they were probably the best team that could compete against the Celtics in this particular finals, considering what everybody was down to.
in the time-space continuum. Right, and part of life is being in the right place at the right time. It's not the Pacers' fault that Giannis got hurt late in the season. It's not the Pacers' fault that the Knicks fell apart like a house of cards as the playoffs in that series went on. Those are uncontrollable things, and you have to play the opponent. So that's why when people say, "Well, Halliburton got hurt," but no. We can't do that. Right. You can't do that in the professional level. It literally is next man up. It is game by game. And as the Pacers move through the season, and you wrote about this eloquently, they had some really, really bad losses to really, really bad basketball teams. Having the big switch, even in the last 2 months, you know, losing to Charlotte, losing to Washington, I mean, just teams they shouldn't get beat by. I know it's the professional ranks, but then to go fight like Boston, fight like that, win a game 7 in New York, did a switch flip? Did the defensive intensity pick up? What was the big change there from getting the 6th seed and staying out of the 7, 8, 9, 10, and then making that leap and playing the Celtics as tough as they did? Did you see anything that just jumped off the page from either Carlisle or this team?
I mean, there were a few things. The one thing I would say about the losing to bad teams, like, that's not necessary. It's almost like they were better off when they were playing good teams, because you know, whenever they played somebody that they knew they should beat, they relaxed, and that was the problem. You know, and like that, they didn't necessarily
immaturity, right?
They just only played good teams in the playoffs, so there was no capacity for just coming in and saying, "Well, we're going to beat these guys." Well, obviously, you aren't going to walk in and beat Milwaukee or New York or Boston. Like, those were three really, really good teams, so they didn't. You didn't have that capacity, so you won't know until next year when they face a Charlotte or a Washington or a Detroit or somebody at the bottom of the East. You know, how they respond to that. I mean, Detroit was the only team they didn't lose to. But everybody else, you know, in the East, they found a way to lose at least one game to, and obviously a handful of really bad teams in the West too, in San Antonio and Portland a couple of times. So you don't know if they fixed that problem, but that was still an immaturity issue. But they, you know, from the beginning got up for really good teams and managed to, you know, like, that was never an issue from the beginning of the year. But, you know, I do think you saw you didn't know how they were going to respond to a 7-game series and what that, you know, how that's a different game of, you know, you play a team one day and then you see what they're going to do and then you go switch, you know, go adapt to that the next game, and then they adapt to you and you adapt to them, and there's the back and forth. So I thought you saw a lot of growth within that. You know, it's just a different that dynamic changes the game so much. I think personally, just from covering it, obviously, and I hadn't covered a playoff series yet up until this point. You know, I was used to, you know, I'm used to NCAA tournament basketball and, you know, one and done kind of stuff. It was interesting to see how that functions up close. And, you know, I do think there was a lot learned from game to game. And I think what was sort of fascinating was how well, and they did this all year, but to do it in the playoffs is still a little bit of a different story, is when they put bad games behind them quickly and sort of
yes.
the lessons without dwelling on them. And they did that all year, but I thought it's still different in a postseason series when someone just whoops your butt and then you have to go play them again. And you're able to say, okay, all right, that doesn't mean they're going to do it twice. This is what we have to do to make sure they don't do it twice. I mean, again, like, some of their losses were bad. You know, I mean, game one against the Bucks was bad. Game one against the Knicks, you know, wasn't great. Game five against the Knicks was horrendous. You know, a game five against the Bucks was pretty bad. I mean, they had a couple in there where they just got smoked, and they were able to say, okay, all right, that's fine.
Yeah, we'll game two okay. against the Celtics, we'll they right. lead by 18 in game three. Right, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, they were able to say at each point, the fact that we just lost this game by a bunch doesn't mean we don't have any business being on the floor with these guys. You know, we can just, like, we had these mistakes, we screwed this up, this is a thing we can fix, you know, or this is an adjustment we can make. And they did a good job of that in each case. And I thought, you know, Carlisle, I think, had some deserved criticism, but, you know, in the midst of that, there was some genius in there, you know, no doubt about it. And I think being able to, you know, coach up a game with no Halliburton in the last two and make it competitive, I think says a lot for him. I think the fact that, you know, and there were long-term, I think, investments made in guys that, you know, I think paid off. I mean, like Andrew Nembhard. I mean, I think there was a lot of belief that, well, he shouldn't have been on the floor, you know, after, you know, in late in game two against the Knicks, you know, when he was getting dusted by Jalen Brunson.
Take a number.
You know, I think, yeah. And so I think what mattered is, like, he made sure that Andrew Nembhard still knew that he had faith in him. He made the change from a defensive standpoint and said, okay, well, you know, we're going to move you over to Dante now. But he didn't take him off the floor. He didn't say, okay, well, TJ is the starter now. You know, like TJ is going to be the guy on Brunson. And TJ did defend him, but, you know, he said, all right, we're going to go with Aaron Nesmith in this case. And so maybe that's going to help us out. We'll go with the length, but he didn't abandon Nembhard. And then Nembhard comes out and had a spectacular Boston series and, you know, gives them a chance, you know, obviously hit the game three, winner against the Knicks to totally turn the tide of that series. And then, you know, did great work, you know, just having to step up and be the point guard against Boston. So, but I think there were a lot of smart moves like that, a lot of just little things that were done, I think, to counter stuff the Knicks were doing. I think the last two games against the Knicks, he did a really good job of, you know, getting Halliburton some space to operate after McBride just kind of took him out of game five. They're like, all right, well, what do we have to do to have a counter for that? They did a lot of, I think, really good off the ball stuff to make sure that Halliburton had some, you know, space to get downhill. And, you know, there were a lot, I think, little tweaks like that Carlisle made. And obviously you saw the experience, the number of playoff games he's been in, his understanding of how these things work. You really saw that shine through in some of those games. I mean, you could say that he got outcoached against Boston, but I think he, at the end of the day, outcoached Tibbs against the Knicks. So, you know, for sure.
I don't think he got outcoached against Boston. I think situationally he let his team down. I think that's a different
argument. In a couple occasions.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a different argument as opposed to, well, sure, you know, Brown gets 40. Well, he gets 40 on everybody. Tatum gets 30. Well, he gets 36 on everybody. Nobody shuts those guys down. But as you mentioned, being in three of those four games, leading by 18 or leading by, was it 98-90? We can go through all these again. I don't want to. I don't want to relive that horror. But they did some really good things. I think each team has to find scar tissue. Each team has to have that callus of that hurt. What do we learn from it and take forward? And I'll leave Halliburton here for a second because I want to go back to Nembhard. But this is why it stinks that Mathurin couldn't play. Not because they would have won the series against Boston, because he didn't get to go through this. He didn't get to go through the grind of that last 5 minutes, up four, down four, whatever it was, in all these close games, and figure out what closing time in the playoffs means. So that's another step the Pacers will have to, you can't replicate that, but Nembhard did. Nembhard did go through it. Mm-hmm. Nembhard was asked to score. He was asked to defend. He was asked to run the team, and that's why the Pacers moved up to get him the first pick in the second round and paid him the big money. I think we saw why.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you definitely saw why. I mean, I think there have been times, certainly he went quiet from a scoring standpoint for a lot of the year, you know, when he was just really sort of focusing on his defensive assignment and just kind of being the secondary ball handler and kind of being the guy who could bring up the floor so that you can move Halliburton around away from the blitzes and the double teams. But, you know, I think first off from the beginning, really, I think even from the Milwaukee series, they said, hey, you know, Andrew, you're going to have to score a little bit more. You know, you're going to have to put the ball in the bucket because there's going to be so much focus on Tyrese and Siakam and, you know, those guys. Like, there are going to be opportunities for you and you got to take them. And he, you know, certainly was better at that the entire series. You know, but I mean, again, he's been a valuable guy the entire time, but you just saw that the scoring is there. He can do it when he wants to.
And the versatility is fantastic. Like, I think that's the
sure.
And he's got great size and huge hands and all the other intangibles that you thought, okay, I could see why the Pacers thought he was a first round talent. Now we got to talk about Halliburton, because I can make a case the Pacers might play a little bit better playoff basketball with Halliburton on the sideline. I know he's not going anywhere. We're going to have growing pains together. We're all going to grow up with Halliburton. We're going to see how this all works, because no one's going to take $55 million of salary. That's just he's not move. He's not going to be traded. We just have to go through the pain together. But can the Pacers style that they post during the regular season, can that translate to an Eastern Conference final or even past then? Because in the playoffs, we've watched it. I know you're just starting to cover it. these games are not wide open, 138-134. These are grind it down. The last 5 minutes is way more half-courty. How does Halliburton grow into that as we move forward? Because it's not a run-and-gun, big-time shootout like the All-Star game when you get to these winning moments.
I mean, I think the most important thing that he's got to do is trust himself. Let's start on the offensive end. I mean, I think defensively you have to say, all right, he's got to be a little bit better there just overall. You know, like you've got to be able to trust him a little bit more defensively. But, I mean, I think, you know, we had all these discussions about aggression. And I think, you know, obviously we finally got to the point where I think he was being sort of more detailed about it. So to start with his sort of definition of how he's going to define his own aggression is it being you got to get 2 feet in the paint. I think, you know, one, you saw more from that in the games that he was winning. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, trust your ability to get there. You know, like you can. You have the capacity. Two, trust your ability to score once you do. And I think so. There's a lot of times where he's gotten in the paint and passed up a floater, you know, gotten in there and throwing it back. And sometimes the throwback works, but sometimes it's like, you know what, you can hit that shot. Just go up and hit it. Like, you can hit a floater. You can, there are some times where he's like, you've got a layup. Just finish the layup. Take 2 points. You know, don't, like, throw it out there for a shot that's maybe 35% successful. Like, yeah, sometimes it works. Sometimes you get 3 instead of 2. But sometimes you have a 2. Just take it. You know, it's there.
And those count as well. We can put those on the scoreboard. That's okay. They're easy to make.
Indeed.
Put them up there.
Indeed. Yeah, so I mean, I think there's some of that. It's just you know, kind of trust yourself. I mean, I think that's kind of what it's got to be for Halliburton going forward, and I'm sure he's going to look at that and see a lot of this on film to say, like, hey, man, you had that. You know, you could have hit that. You could score over that guy. You know, believe in yourself. You know, believe that you're that good. And, you know, again, you saw really, really good moments from him in these playoffs. And so, I mean, like, the flashes are there. Like, he can be that kind of player. And so I think that's I think he's going to be okay with it. I mean, I think you're going to see that he's going to have some capacity to be able to go make a play when he has to make a play. You know, I think his future does, you know, he still has to get stronger. I mean, he said it and acknowledged this, but I think it's really, really important. I mean, I think what you saw, and he mentioned this overall, saying that, like, it was good for him to play the Knicks and see the level of physicality and the importance of rebounding. And how that's going to really teach him lessons going forward. You know, and he was really glad that he got to play those guys in his first playoffs to really get a sense of that. But I mean, I think another piece to it is seeing why Jalen Brunson was able to so frequently get a shot, you know, and frequently get to his. And a big part of it is that Jalen is strong enough to just go in the lane and bounce off of people and get, you know, get space to score. And, you know, to become anything like that, like, he's never going to have that build. He's never going to be that kind of muscle bowling ball that Jalen Brunson is, but he needs to have more of that. He needs to be able to kind of maintain his balance and, you know, maintain, you know, just sort of stay on his feet when he gets hit, and be able to get hit, come off of that, and get a shot out of it, you know. And that's,
well, the other thing is he's a great free throw shooter, so you're not going to get any free throws shooting 26-foot step backs. You're not going to get free points that way. You're not going to get free points if you're not going to shoot layups. You're not going to get free points if you don't get to the line. And that's the next you're right, that's the next level of his development is, number one, eat a sandwich, please. Can you have maybe two? And get in the weight room. Miles Turner took a couple years before he figured out, hey, this ain't going to work. I'm 6'11", but I got to get stronger. My legs got to get stronger. I got to be able to grind and get into the paint and do all that. So we're going to grow along with Halliburton. I think Pacer fans were excited to see that even when he didn't play, it was not the end of the world. NBA teams cannot be that way. You and I know that, but fans don't always like, oh, Halliburton's out, series is over. Well, that's not how it works. So that's the good news. All these guys got out of their comfort zones and got uncomfortable, and the Pacers gave him a hell of a fight. Dustin Dupirak is our guest this afternoon, at Dustin Dupirak, IndyStar.com, beat writer for Pacer basketball. Is the Pacer team, the way it's constructed now, we'll get to Siakam here just quickly, I'll tie this all together, are they too young? Do they have too many young, undefined pieces? Do we need to package some of those up and get some veteran guys to push the core group forward? We talked earlier in the year about having too many of Jalen Smith, Isaiah Jackson, et cetera, et cetera. Now we got too many. You got too many guards, too many wing players. Well, a lot of these guys are signed. What is the next step for this roster construction, in your opinion, from Chad Buchanan and Rick Carlisle?
Yeah, no, it's tough to say. I mean, obviously, when you talk, like, there's a reason we talked to Chad and not Kevin. I think. I mean, like, this is my theory, is that, you know, when Kevin talks, you kind of, like, he is more truthful. He is more likely to just kind of, like, let out what he's thinking and, like, what he's playing with. And Chad is less likely to do that. And I think that's a bigger reason why we keep getting Chad for these media availabilities and less Kevin, because Kevin was way more interested in making his thinking public. So you kind of don't know. I mean, Chad's just doing the very, you know, like, we'll look for everything, but we're okay with this. And it's sort of like, I will not commit to anything in a press conference, which is probably the smart way to do it. It's less fun for us, but it's probably the smart way to do it. But, you know, I think, I mean, if they run it back with this group, it wouldn't shock me. I think there's a lot that they like, and I think they still see room for internal growth. And I think enough strides were made this year to get a better sense of who's close and what they have to do. And the direction that they have to take and what they're going to need to get to be the player that they need them to be. So I don't, there is, I think, something to say for consolidation. There is something to say for, okay, we got to get, some guys with a little bit more grit and whatnot. You know, I think they're just going to have to wait and see though what, you know, what they're able to do as far as re-signing is concerned. I mean, I think obviously.
Well, Siakam's got to be the first point on that. Yeah, that's the number one, number one thing. So
that's priority one. And then it's okay, like, what are you willing to give for Obi? You know, how important? I mean, I think they'd like to have him, but obviously, if someone is going to make a ridiculous offer, they're not.
Well, that's the number. That's the number one rule in NBA free agency. There is a team that will always overpay. Always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Always,
and
always.
I mean, they were the team that overpaid. They were the team that overpaid last year. I mean, like, you know, what was funny about last year was they had to find somebody to overpay. You know,
yes.
They were actually, because Ty's you know, contract extension didn't kick in until this year. You know, basically they had this pile of money.
Here you go, Miles. Here's $20 million. Enjoy it.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And then it was Bruce Brown.
Right.
Basically, like, Miles and Bruce were in both of those cases. Certainly Miles, it was just, hey, this is a way of us showing our appreciation. We have it. You know, we can give it to you. And so we will. You know, we're not going to just keep it just because we can. But to get above the floor, they had to spend the amount of money they spent on Bruce Brown, you know, just to make sure that they were taking up some of that salary and they weren't below, you know, they weren't just going to be penalized for being below the floor.
Right.
So they had to overpay for somebody. And so they liked Bruce Brown, and I think he was useful. And obviously he ended up being the piece that gets you over the top to get Siakam. So,
well, that's
that ended
that's,
up being a good payoff.
Yeah, that it worked out beautifully. I agree with that 100%. Mm-hmm. The Jairus Walker draft pick is the one that still has me scratching my head, because you had to go out and get Siakam. You bring in a top 10 guy who's 6'8", 6'9", 6 whatever, who was under the guise, if you read any pre-draft stuff, about defense and rebounding for Kelvin Sampson, and then all you needed to do was have him defend wings, which killed the Pacers all year, and we didn't see a lot of him on the floor. How patient do you think they will be with Walker? I know he's not the linchpin to free agency or anything else, but
sure.
Is that somebody you say, hey, well, we can move him along, put him in a package somewhere to bring in more veteran players? Play GM for a minute for me.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, I don't think they, it's not off the table, but, I mean, I think there was a good amount of sort of, you know, rumor reporting. I mean, just to how, you know what happens when it comes to these trades and whatnot, but the stuff that was kind of going around was that the Pacers had told the Raptors, we're not giving you Jairus Walker for Pascal Siakam, basically that's a line that we're going to draw. And so, That obviously, I mean, based on how they've talked about him, based on how Carlisle's talked about him, how Buchanan has talked about him, they do really like what they see, and they would like to see it play out to see what kind of player he becomes. They're really impressed by the feel he's got for the game. You know, just, I mean, he's, a lot of times when he's out there in those garbage minutes, he's bringing the ball up. And
I noticed that. He's a great passer, I thought, from what I saw.
He's a fantastic passer. He's a fantastic passer, and he's still, and he and I asked him about this. We talked about this. I thought it was really interesting. He played point guard as a sophomore at IMG, And he says he still sees the game that way. And from a, you know, looking forward and being, you know, like bringing the ball up type of way of how he sees the floor and just how he functions, it's the way that he feels most comfortable is bringing the ball up and being the guy who's initiating offense. And that's really interesting for a guy of that size. So that's valuable. And, you know, obviously on the flip side of that, you have plenty of point guards. It's not like you need him to be that guy. But it's nice to know. And they obviously feel like they can play him at multiple positions. They feel like there's just a lot of growth for him in terms of what he could become. So I guess they want to see a little bit more before they're willing to move him. That being said, you know, there is, I imagine there are scenarios there's probably players out there that they could look at and say, okay, well, that's worth giving up on this for.
The other side of this is you have Toppin as an unrestricted free agent that we talked about. Well, you've drafted that position. I know it's not the same guy doing the same stuff, but if the Pacers are going to make a move for a bigger player, these draft picks have to pan out. That's the whole key to this roster building, isn't it?
Sure. And so, I mean, it's got to work out, but I mean, I think there's also a question of when, there's a question of timing and saying, all right, well, you might say to yourself, well, I want to move this. I'd be willing to move this at some point, but it depends on what it's for. And, you know, while I have it, I want to see what it becomes. I mean, I think in both Mather and Walker's case, you're looking at, you can say, all right, well, I'm a little bit nervous about this. There's this part of his game that I'm a little bit nervous about that I'm not sure if he's going to pan out. You know, this isn't moving as quickly as I'd like it to. But in the same sign, there's also points that you're looking at and saying, you know what, those tools are good enough that I want to see what they become. I want to see if we can turn, I want to see if we can fix these issues. You know, you're still talking about a very, very young person. There's still this much capacity for growth in his game. You know, I want to see what this looks like before I make a decision. You know, if something comes along that I feel like I can't pass up, then I won't pass it up. But, you know, while I have this, I want to see what it becomes and I do want to develop it. So I think that's kind of where they are with both players, is saying, you know, like, obviously, to your point, I mean, their top 10 picks, they hadn't had guys picked in the top 9 since the 80s. And so these guys are in a rare position of being a huge investment for them from a draft standpoint, compared to what they've had, you know, just throughout the franchise, because they've been so sort of solid, steady, at least being an okay team. They've rarely been as bad as they were a couple of years ago. And so, you know, like you would think, all right, well, that's your rare opportunity to have a guy pick this high. He's got to pan out. And I think they view it as he has to, and they both have to, but, you know, it might end up being that they get the value from it, you know, in a trade, that eventually that's how this thing works, is that Walker ends up being a trade piece or that Mather ends up being a trade piece. But I think they're still in the case of believing that both of those guys can be stars in their own way, and they want to see what it looks like before they make a move. But also, you know, they could also just increase value. I mean, I think you saw Walker get talked about a lot more after he had a really good performance at the G League Showcase, basically at the Showcase Cup in I think it was Orlando, basically around December. And so they really liked, a lot of people really liked what they saw from there, and I think they want to see more of it. And, you know, maybe that leads to being able to make a big move with him at some point.
Well, you just hope he's not a 4A player, a baseball analogy.
Sure.
You just hope he dominates the G League and then he plays and he struggles at the next level. We'll eventually figure that out.
There's a chance that, like, that might be what Oscar Tshiebwe is.
I thought that when he came up. If you can't score outside of 6 feet in the NBA, it doesn't matter how many rebounds you get. We'll find a guy to get rebounds and shoot from outside 6 feet. And that goes back to the point about Walker and Mathurin. The league is all guys that look like them. You got to have those guys. Look at Boston. Derek White, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum. That's where those teams excel. You got 6'9" guys shooting threes in the corner. All the stuff. That's the right framework of it, I think. And that's why I think you have to re-sign Siakam. Siakam does too many things. He has he has basically the only playoff library of experience to go through. Heck, the Pacers hadn't been that deep since 2014. Miles has had a little bit here and there, but he has to be number one on your offseason list. The Canadian connection, I know the agents are somebody, Nembhard's got the same agent or whatever else. Do you see this as being a long drawn out process, or is he gonna investigate all his options, or is this gonna come back to the Pacers in your opinion?
I mean, it seems like it's going in that direction. I mean, the only thing that, just from, you know, just reading what was in front of me in terms of, like, you know, body language, how they were talking, you know, all those kinds of things. I mean, like Pascal was truly, I think, really touched. I mean, I think it was something to say. The Pascal had been a fine quote for us and everything like that, but I mean, he really kind of opened up a little bit in this kind of end of season and end of game interview when he just said, you know, I really appreciated just how much support I was shown because it was hard. I mean, he used the term breakup for leaving Toronto because of how much time he put in there. And he said, basically, I mean, that was really hard to leave. And so it meant a lot that Indiana came up with as much support as they did, basically to make it clear to them that they were that he was wanted and needed. And I think, I don't think Indiana could have done any more. I won't say right now that there's 0% chance that he looks at another situation and thinks it's better. You know, I don't think there's a 0% chance of that.
Well, it doesn't hurt that the Pacers have his bird rights too, correct?
Right, exactly. They can make a 5-year offer where everybody else can only make a 4-year offer.
And so that's a big deal when you're 30. Big deal.
It is a significant deal when you're 30. But I think it's also a situation of he knows that if he makes the long-term decision with the Pacers, then he's putting all of his chips in there. That if he's going to win another title, if he's going to rise up at all, like, it's got to be with them. And so if he has any thoughts of, actually, I want to bounce around a little bit more, I want to see the league, I want to be, you know, see how this team works or that team works, and I'd rather, you know, the rest of my years be spent that way, you know, he could go another
route. Or you just go the Al Horford route. You turn 34 and you just bounce around to whoever the highest bidder is come playoff time, and you jump on that
one. Yeah, exactly.
So
do I think that's going to do that? I don't know. But, I mean, at this point, I do also think that he likes what he sees. He sees a team that's got a good chance. He was the guy who did point out to say, like, okay, just because you got there doesn't mean – you're going to be there next year. Like, you can't think of it as you're going to build. Like, you have to think of it as you still have to get back here. Like, it's going to take everybody as much work to get back to being in the Eastern Conference Finals, much less taking the step beyond that.
The other side of this coin, though, I think that Siakam is making the case for is there's no dead weight really hanging onto the Pacers. There's not a big overhanging contract you have to move. There are not two or three guys that are expiring in the sense of playability at an Eastern Conference Final. It's a team on the way up, and it's exciting. And as you mentioned, the community and city have really wrapped that up. He does have some interesting quotes, and we heard it, and I heard him from you that he really didn't give the Pacers everything in his full bag yet because they didn't need it yet. So I'm kind of intrigued by that next step once everybody gets it figured out. And I think just simply, he's one of the few Pacers who can get his own shot. He'll back you in, turn you left, turn you right, up and under the whole bag of moves. That is huge for perhaps Nembhard, who's a little bit better at it than Halliburton, but Halliburton has struggled to get his own shot. You have to have guys when things break down, and Mathurin, I think, fits into that category as well.
Yes.
He's going to get the max deal, isn't he, from the Pacers? That's just how this is going to work?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine not. I asked Chad Buchanan that point blank, and he wouldn't tell me, but I just can't imagine they won't.
What do you think you're going to ask him? You know, what did you have for lunch today?
Yeah. Like, no, I can't say that. We got him to say, you know, basically we really like this, you know, that kind of thing. But, I mean, I just wanted to see if he would go there. He said at the beginning, you know, I'm not going to
negotiate in the press.
Right.
We're not going to litigate this case in the media. Right. We get it.
Yeah. But bottom line, I mean, I just can't imagine why they wouldn't. You know, I mean, I think Rick Carlisle coming out and saying, you know, I mean, like, this was unprompted. I mean, we just kind of said, like, what do you
think? That's a great clue, isn't it? Yeah.
It was just, we need to now recruit Pascal Siakam in earnest. He's like, we've been doing this the whole time, but basically but you need to make it clear that he's your guy. And I think that was Rick's way of saying that was Rick's way of saying we're making a max offer. I mean, like, I don't think that that I think got it all across. I mean, I'm not saying anything. There was no conversation beyond that. I'm not talking about, like, somebody told me this off the record. I'm just basing it on, like, when Rick opens up without us asking, you know, what are you going to do with Pascal? Like him saying, you know, basically that's got to be our primary focus, you know, just saying, I want that out there. I want to make sure everybody knows I said it. I want that to be in the media. You know, I want that to be the quote you guys put on Twitter right now and write a story about.
Yeah. No mixed messages. No confusion. Nothing's lost. Nothing's lost in translation. Well, nothing gets lost in translation with you, buddy. I'm going to have you back if you are not in Bora Bora or Tahiti. let's go the week before the draft. I know the Pacers do not have a number one pick, but free agency tends to, the rumors and everything else start percolating during that week, and the Pacers do have some assets, and I know by then you'll have probably a little bit more information for us as well. So let's get caught up the week before the draft, and we'll see what the Blue and Gold has in store for the offseason as we move closer to the official start, which is when? Is that the Monday after 4th of July when the league calendar turns over? I know there's a silly date for that.
It's the 30th, so the league calendar turns. So now Saturday. It's always July 1st.
Oh, okay.
They moved it up to 6 p.m. on the 30th, basically. You kind of end of business on the 30th.
Which is a Sunday, interestingly enough. I think I have that right.
Yes, it is a Sunday.
So that means Mondays, there you go. Got all day Monday to talk about it, and that's not surprising. Yep. Okay, great. So that'll take us to free agency and what's percolating there, the draft, and any other movement that's going on. Hey, thanks for making time for me today. I love it. I know you're busy tonight. Have a great time out and about, and enjoy a couple days off putting your feet up, buddy.
Appreciate it. Will do, sir.
That's our great friend Dustin Dupirak from the Indianapolis Star, at Dustin Dupirak on the X, IndyStar.com. As we always beg you, please, please, please buy subscriptions. Support these local journalists that get inside and tell the great stories of everything that's going on. We thank Dustin for being with us today. We thank you for being with us today. We're back on Thursday tomorrow, and we'll get things rolling. Our friends at Ivy Tech, Diane Daly, Joe Smith, Michelle Moss, and Zach Osterman will be in the Crazy Horse Tavern Happy Hour. Have a great Wednesday night. We'll see you tomorrow.